Harambe, Harambe, Harambe.
Working together for progress.
Feel the oneness of Harambe.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
Keep it right there.
Show. Hello, Lafayette Harambe listeners. This is your host, Baye Kemet, on our show tonight at 9 p.m., The Liberated Zone. And The Liberated Zone is a space in which African people are free to express their paradigms of philosophy, their ideologies, and their paradigms of practice. Tonight, I have as my ghost, my guest. I'm thinking of the O in the Oba, so I apologize for that, but my guest, no other than my friend, my brother, my esteemed elder, not too much of an elder, but eldership in terms of age, my brother, Oba Sekou Olayinka. And I want to thank you for coming on tonight, Baba.
No problem, but thank you.
Yes, sir. This is like a regular conversation for us, man, you know, so I'm looking forward to this. We can chop it up for a good hour, you know?
Absolutely. Very good.
Get something constructive out of it. But
yes,
you know, for the listening audience, I just want to let everybody know that Baba Sekou and I have known each other for about 7 years now. I remember in November of 2002 when I walked into Egbe Sankofa at the time, which is now Egbe Ijoba, and became a participant at the time, but later on a member of Egbe Sankofa, Kingdom of Gods of Africa. Is that correct?
Yes, that was the name then. Yes,
you're right at the time, right? And which was a Yoruba temple in Philadelphia, located at 51st and Walnut. And over the time, Baba Sekou had, of course, performed various spiritual, rituals for myself and my family, and over the time we began to grow not only as I would say client and priest and client, but you know, as brothers in the struggle and the work that we are doing. And so again, I want to thank you for coming on the show today. And you know, before we get into any discussion, I just want you to please offer a brief bio or a brief description of who you are and what you've done and your work in Philadelphia.
Okay. Again, it's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. Again, I'm Oba Sekou Olayinka. I'm born the oldest son of Chief Oba Numi, Ogun Sheye, and Oshun Priestess Omowumi, Ogun Daisi. And I am 42. I'll be 43 in about, a couple days, really, I think. July 7th, I guess it's about 7, 8 days away. Married, I have two children. I'm an initiated priest of Obatala. It'll be 15 years in November I'll have been initiated. I am also a student of Ifa, and if all goes well, I'll be headed to Nigeria, West Africa, by or before the fall to be initiated to Ifa.
Gotcha.
We started the temple, Ile Iwapele, which translates to mean the House of General Character, back on September 14th, 1997, and we have been at our present location since April of 1999, and we have had regular veneration services on Sundays since 1997. And we started a school about 4 years ago, Ijoba Shule. That's our school for the instruction of our children. And we have a small bookstore, Community Development Corporation, and more to come. And these are the different organizations that comprise what's known as collectively as Egbe Ijoba, which translates to mean the sovereignty or sovereign society. So that is, who we are. We don't measure membership by numbers. We measure them by families. And we have a good 7, 8 families that comprise Egbe Ijoba at this time. And we are persevering, brother, as you well know. We're persevering along, with everybody else in this sovereignty movement.
Ashe. So, how did you decide, and I think I might know some of these questions, but, just for the larger audience, for people that don't know, but how did you decide to, get off, I guess, the beaten track of, going, through the academic route, getting a 9-to-5 and taking the economic, you know, road to safety and security, and, you know, work this beaten path of being sovereign. You know, with all the added, I guess, pressures and struggles it is to, you know, maintain all of the facilities and businesses that we have with independent money. You know, what made you stay on that path?
Well, I'll answer the first part, you know, first, which is what, you know, how did we get to that? And it really just came from an analysis of history of people's, you know, Kabiyesi, Ibaye, His Royal Highness, Oba, Osurgeon, Adelabwadi Fumi, the first king of Oyotunji Village, and looking at his life, my father, his struggles in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s to start and to continue and consistently a temple in Philadelphia. And I realized that, you know, and you look at what other people are doing. You look at what, you know, other groups are doing. You look at, you know, Catholics, you look at Jews, you look at Buddhists. We studied the Hare Krishnas. And why were they able to start institutions around the same time as Kabiyesi, Ibaye, and my father? And those institutions were able to be maintained and sustained, and why, you know, it was so difficult for African institutions to be maintained. And what I developed and what I, you know, concluded was that you have to dedicate your life to it. You have to dedicate your life to it. So what I tried to do was try to build a family and a community around that family, or better yet, make my family a part of a community that would allow me to dedicate the better part of my waking hours to, you know, the building and maintaining of institutions for the sovereignty of African people. And I've structured my family that way, and we live, you know, corporately and together, and that allows me to do it. But again, this has to be done as families, as community, and there is no other way. But again, it was a necessity of the institutions. You know what I mean? We can't sit there and talk about the white man, his schools, and this and the third. If you're not willing to build your own, you can't sit there and talk about him. If you're not willing to build your own communities and the institutions that community needs to survive. So it was done out of necessity and what I like to call an acceptance of the brutal facts of reality. And that's why and how we've done what we've been able to do.
So in terms of blending the Yoruba tradition with the sovereignty movement, of course, you know, we both know that in America, being a Yoruba practitioner, a Orisha practitioner, it is not, I guess, it doesn't go hand-in-hand in terms of being sovereign thinking and sovereign-minded. Many people will extract the tradition from any kind of political or cultural statement. And so in doing that, the question I'm trying to figure out is how important is it that we continue to use sovereignty or continue to put sovereignty at the forefront of our spiritual, political, and cultural movement? This is the question I want to know.
Yeah, very good question. Well, first of all, let's go back. Again, you have to always, this whole thing is about Sankofa, or what Kabiyesi Ibaye called the African Cultural Restoration Movement. If you look at this thing, Kabiyesi was a nationalist. You know, my father was a nationalist. That's part of what attracted him to the Yorubas in New York, in Harlem, back in 1961-62. Was my father was a nationalist. He always, even when we were being raised in the house, he said, "Son, you know, we practice Orisha tradition and all that." He says, "But I was a nationalist before I was an Orisha, so in my house it was natural. It was never a problem understanding the role that Pan-African nationalism played in Orisha worship, if you will, or Orisha practice." But the necessity for it, as far as sovereignty is concerned, is that, again, we as African people cannot allow other people's definitions to become our definitions. And by that I mean is that this idea that there's some kind of separation between church and state is absolutely ridiculous. The African people, culture was spiritual, and their spirituality is their culture. Another way of saying that is, as Dr. Clark taught us, he says, all religion or spirituality is the deification of a people's history. So if a people is truly a people, that means they have politics, they have economics, they have familial situations, they have all the different areas, military, they have all the areas of life that all people have to deal with if they're going to move forward and progress on this planet. So for people to become a part of the Orisha tradition and just say, I'm listening to the spiritual part, I'm not into the political part, well, I don't know how you do that. You know, I don't know how that's done. To me and even to you, and we've had many conversations on this, they're concomitant. They come together. They're like, you know, most people, and I was, when you buy a pair of gloves, you buy a pair of gloves for, you know, how they look and how they're going to match up with your suit and everything and all. But the part that really you buy it for is the part that you don't see. You've got to keep your hands warm. You know, very few people turn the gloves inside out. And the same thing with this is that you cannot separate spirituality from your politics and your military and your economics. It all goes together. And that's part of the reason why African people suffer so is that we're so disjointed. You know, we think that we can be Africans in the spiritual side, but we can be Negroes and black people socially. And then we wonder why, you know, we don't improve our condition as a people. So it goes together. There is no other way. And to be honest with you, I don't understand how a person can call himself nationalistic and not be spiritual. And I don't understand how a person can call himself spiritual and not be nationalistic. They're you know, they go hand in hand. You can't separate them.
So, you know, with that being said, then, you know, and I know this is really, you know, I guess a wide, you know, wide question for, you know, a broad question for you, but where do you see the Yoruba tradition in America going, you know? Where do you see it today, and where do you see it going? I mean, I know you, growing up in a tradition, have seen it come from a place almost very far, and from what I've, you know, you've told me, your father told me, and even what he has told me, that it was just like, sort of like the King's children were talking about how a lot, all these people talk about they were marching with Dr. King back in the day. He's like, I remember all the people marching with us, you know what I mean? When we looked up, it was like 20 of us out there. You know, I remember. Right. I know you remember those days that, you know, it wasn't everybody out here, you know, with their lakes on and talking about their warriors and so forth and so on. So, judging from your, you know, your historical perspective, where do you see the Orisha tradition in America today? And if we're not careful, where do you see it going?
Well, today I see the Orisha community at a serious crossroads, and this is as a result of neglected and deferred decisions that certain people who today would be considered elders, decisions and choices that they made 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago that they either deferred on or just chose not to stand strong on them, they put our community, by our, I mean African people in America, our communities in a very precarious situation. The Orisha tradition to me is not good, and I'll explain. We have more initiated so-called full Orisha or priests than we've ever had. We've got more Baba Lals and Iyanifa, which are, you know, high priests, you know, than we've ever had. Yet we have more confusion. We have less institutions in our communities that are life-giving and life-sustaining. We have less families being formed, you know, this whole baby mama and baby papa and divorce and homosexuality and all these issues are affecting the Yoruba community just like they're affecting the broader African community here in America. So right now I would say that we are in a real crossroads right now. We really have to decide, you know, are we going to practice the culture of this tradition the way it's meant to be practiced and use it to pull together our families and our homes, to pull together our communities, and to do the things that this tradition is capable of doing and taking us, you know, and the places it's capable of taking us to. And if we don't, the future is not going to be bright. If we do, then the future, you know, again, we will continue to heal and heal the wounds of slavery and Jim Crow. And to recover our culture, recover our sense of self, to recover our national and ethos as African people, we'll become self-sufficient, self-reliant, we'll be able to feed, clothe, house, educate, medicate, entertain, and govern, and protect ourselves. These are the basic, you know, requirements for nationhood. But again, if we don't, I see us, again, just like everything else, I see us losing this tradition. I see Europeans and other non-Africans, not just Europeans, taking control of our tradition just like they did with Christianity back in the day, just like they've done with Judaism, just like they've done with all a lot of the major world, you know, traditions that were once purely African sciences, and other people are going to own it. And the reason why I say that is because we live in America, and in America everything is commoditized. Everything in America ultimately comes down to a dollar, and we are at the bottom of the economic pile, so we can't play that game. And if we do, it's just a matter of time before somebody else owns it. We have an Odu.
Right.
And I can't recall the Odu right now. I apologize. I don't want to call the wrong Odu. But it says if you don't have character and you have children, your children belong to someone else. If you have money but you don't have character, your money belongs to someone else. If you have titles and property and whatever it is, and you don't have character, all those things belong to someone else. And this is where we are. We have many people in this tradition that are selling out the tradition for a dollar to make their living, and they're initiating all sorts of people that don't qualify, and they're putting people in this tradition that really have not displayed the kind of character that they should have displayed to be a part of this tradition. And just like everything else in America, money cheapens everything, and that is our battle. Because we're so hungry for resources and for money and for the things that money can buy, we sell out a beautiful and glorious tradition, and ultimately, at the end of the day, we'll lose it if we don't change.
So I appreciate that, Baba. I appreciate your response on that. I mean, coming from you, you know, again, someone in the Philadelphia community, you know, I've had long discussions with your father and your mother in relationship to them being one of the first in Philadelphia practicing the Orisha tradition. And, you know, and I know you all have a panoramic view of, you know, how we should practice the tradition and, you know, how things are going. So I really appreciate your response on that question. Now, changing speed just a little bit, you know, I want to connect what we're talking about in terms of sovereignty and in terms of the Yoruba tradition to African-centered education. And I know a few months ago, you and I were on Brother Butch Slaughter's show, Funny, on Harambe Radio, together, twice, discussing this notion of African-centered education. And there was a discussion prior to, I don't know if you listened to the show, at 8 o'clock before, and they were discussing an African-centered conference that took place in Washington, D.C. this weekend. And, you know, so in terms of this notion of being in a position to educate our own children, whether it be homeschooling, whether it be online African-centered schools, whether it be the actual, you know, Shule institution, what have you, you know, I just want you to talk a little bit about the importance, you know, of African people today, but then, of course, moving into the future of being able to own our own institutions and being able to educate our own children.
Well, again, it's absolutely essential, and you and I have talked about this before, but again, the gazelle does not send its offspring off to the lion or the leopard to learn how to run. And it just comes down to that. It's just common sense. We are a damaged people, and again, I don't want to go off subject, but even the example, one thing the example of Michael Jackson to teach us is really the depths to which our people's souls have been seared and damaged by racism and white world supremacy in all its various forms, whether it's religious or political or cultural or economic or military. And Michael's life and his face and the way he looks is he morphed in front of us, but as he did so, he became a walking example of the self-hatred of our people and the lack of confidence and the lack of love of self of our people. And these things become exemplary of why we do not create institutions, why we're looking for validation and accreditation and acceptance from other people that have clearly proven to us and to the rest of the world that they really don't give a damn about us, they don't really care about us, and they don't really, you know, really we're just something to be used, or, you know, if need be, to make a dollar or to gain advantage on. So African-centered education is absolutely positively 100% essential. Matter of fact, in our sense, we call it African-centered education only because I believe we live in a society that is not African, and therefore we have to qualify it. But basically, the education of African people, and African children in particular, can only happen, can only occur if African people provide it. And as Baba Ajay has said many times in his lectures and in his books, this, the teacher, him or herself, is the curriculum. Therefore, only African people can educate African children to be Africans.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not the curriculum that's on paper or the way that's not the curriculum. The teacher is the curriculum. Their example, their passion, their consistency with the principles and values of this culture that we call African is the ultimate curriculum, the ultimate example to our children and to our students. And their creativity as teachers will ultimately bring out, you know, the best in those students and the African in those students and develop the African in them. So, and again, we can look at this in other traditions. You know, if you look in the Arab world or the Muslim world, who creates Muslims? You know, they go to those schools and they study, you know, the Quran, they learn how to read and write. But the first thing they know how to read and write is the Quran. You know what I'm saying? The Jews do something similar. You know, they go to those Talmudic schools and they learn the Torah. And that's all they do in many, you know, many places. So only Jews can produce Jews. And that's the way it's supposed to be. Only Muslims can produce Muslims, or Arabs can produce Arabs. And only Africans can produce Africans. So it's absolutely essential if we're going to continue to exist in this world as African people. And I don't mean biological Africans. That's another thing, too. A lot of times I think black people, and I differentiate black people from African people. Black people think because they see other people that look black, what they consider to be black, that black people ain't going nowhere. It's not the physical black people. We have millions and millions of physical, probably almost a billion
physical looking black people, what we would call black people, we don't have that many Africans. An African is a state of mind. An African is a person that believes in certain kinds of things, has certain kind of values, has certain kind of mores, has a certain kind of worldview. And these things come from the culture. These things come from the practice of the spirituality. These things come from, you know, the outlook. For example, and I'll give a couple of things. Number one, we believe in Ma'at. If you want to be an African, you have to believe in Ma'at. You have to believe in truth, justice, and reciprocity as the organizing principle for the entire universe. Not just here on Earth, but everywhere. The universe is created in and out of Ma'at. And that is what we should strive to represent, to be, and to constantly promote in our very beings. So Ma'at, as a value, as a principle, is to practice that, to be that, to seek to attain that in your being and everything and all the institutions around you, is to be African. So it's not just the physical. A lot of times we want to, black people, no. To be an African, you have to have a certain set of values, a certain outlook on the world. Another value, for example, is that we have to believe in the unity of all African people around the world, no matter where they are. That's an African value, a traditional Pan-African value. The African people are related no matter where we are in the world. That we all ultimately draw our DNA and our source from the ancient Nile or Hopi Valley, in what we would call today the ancient, Nile Valley, but the Hopi Valley that goes all the way down into what today we would call Tanzania. That all of us, that's where we come from. That's where we are, our source. So these are the things that make you an African. If you don't know these things, how can you possibly be an African? You know what I'm saying? So I say all that just to say that, once again, these are the things the African-centered education is designed to inculcate and to place inside of the hearts and minds of African children, so that we grow up and we act out of these values and we live out of these values, and instead of being lived, we live.
So then, in terms of African-centered education and spirituality, I mean, I know that Ijoba Shule of Philadelphia, I would say, is a Yoruba-based school, or it was a Yoruba school. I don't know how you all actually, categorize it, but I would say it is a Yoruba-based school that, some of the principals or what have you, but fundamentally it's a culturally based school, an African cultural school that can pan across Yoruba, Akan, many other traditions or what have you. But the fundamental point is that you all have a spiritual, cultural base to the institution. So
absolutely.
Can an African-centered school be basically African-centered if it doesn't have a spiritually based a premise to it?
The short answer to that is no, but I'll go back and I'm going to explain that. Again, I said earlier, African people have always been a spiritual people. Spirituality is manifested in every aspect of our culture, so therefore it's more correct than what we call it in our temple. We consider ourselves practitioners of a traditional African cultural system, not a traditional African spiritual system. Because, again, in the West, the way the definitions have been laid down in this society, and because we're not using African language, words are loaded. So you use certain kind of words, spiritual, automatically you become categorized as religious or in that realm over there. Whereas if you say cultural, then it gives you a lot more wider berth. You know what I mean? When we think of Chinese people, we don't think of Chinese religion. We think of martial arts. We think of traditional Chinese dance. You think of the architecture, the Great Wall of China. All these things are aspects of Chinese culture. So the Chinese are seen as a cultural people. The characters, their language. So we want to be viewed the same way. So we say yes, that in order to be an African-centered education, the foundation of it has to be cultural. And since the culture of African people is spiritually based, therefore it has to be spiritual by definition. But we wouldn't have to use verbalize it that way to most people because, y'all are religious school. Well, no, it's not just that. And therein comes the problem. So, and again, that's why we have to teach African language in our school so we can begin to use terms that accurately capture what it is we're trying to say, because English and other European and other non-African languages don't always allow us to express what we really mean.
I don't mean to, you mentioned something, and it's on the forefront of my mind, and it's going to really change speech, but we'll get back on this subject, though. But you mentioned Michael Jackson, you know what I'm saying?
Yes,
I know this is like out of left field, I was talking to someone the other day, and I said to them I thought it was very interesting how a person's death can restore their legacy, and when Michael Jackson died, it appears as though that the whole world is in shock. And I remember you were discussing yesterday how news media have now tried to compare his death to, to Frank Sinatra, Elvis, and all these other kinds of people, which really doesn't compare. But from an entertainment perspective, I don't know if you saw the BET Awards or not and what have you, but, you know, can you just speak to, you know, this sense of, you know, this ultra reality that black people are living through media, through hip-hop, through entertainment, through sports. You know, we were talking, I think today, I had mentioned to you, or yesterday I was mentioning to you about the HBO special that's on with Real Sports with Jim Brown.
Right.
And and Bill Russell, right, you know. So can you just speak to this notion that black people, especially we may have parents that are listening, we may have educators, what have you, that think that the right way is to send our children through entertainment or athletics and those kind of things in order for people to attain wealth so that we can have, you know. So it's this whole model of have so that we can be able to do so we can be versus being so we can do in order to have. So can you speak to the notion of black people using entertainment, using, athletics or what have you, make some sense of a nationhood for ourselves?
Well, again, part of the reason why black people gravitate toward athletics and entertainment is because it's one of the few areas where they were allowed to express themselves almost fully. It was one of the few areas where it wasn't automatically a given that we were racially inferior to Europeans. So once blacks, you know, learned this or found this out, you know, many, many people think that's the way to economic advance, that's the way to social acceptance from the larger, you know, non-African world. But again, it's an age-old trap. At the end of the day, Michael Jackson, as rich as he was, as influential as he was as a so-called cultural icon, was at the end of the day, he was nothing more than a cog in the wheel. Michael Jackson had about as much control over his life as, you know, the average daily, you know, black person, you know, or, you know, in America on a given day. Michael Jackson, even this 50-city tour he was going to do, he was doing that because he had to get out of debt. Michael Jackson owed a lot of people money. And, you know, it's really kind of a shame that a 50-year-old man has to come out of retirement. Now, he hasn't toured in what? I think like 10 years, somebody said? At least 10 years. Why did he have to come out of retirement to tour if he has all this money and all this talent? The other thing we have to realize is this, that Michael Jackson is a product of the media. Michael Jackson was built up, and, yes, his talent took him there, don't get me wrong, but the media, he was a media darling back in the early and mid-'80s. He saved the music industry. His album, Thriller, saved the entire music industry. It gave it another 10 or 15 year run. The music industry was in decline prior to Thriller's release. So he became their darling child. But then when the devastation and the effects of slavery began to manifest themselves, i.e. his constant nose jobs and the chin jobs and the lightening of the skin and all the other things he began to go through, became evident. Now all of a sudden he's wacko jacko. He's crazy, you know, and the chimpanzees and the animals and all that kind of stuff. And again, that was frustration. That was, you know, self-hatred and you know, at its highest levels. Remember, Michael's money allowed him to do those things. The scary thing is that everybody talks about Michael, but the sad fact is, and I know you would agree with me, if most black people, if a lot of black people had the kind of money and the resource and the ability to do the things that Michael did, we'd have a whole lot more people walking around here with smaller noses and lighter skin and stuff like that. Y'all just can't afford it. So therefore, you suffer as you know, in the bodies that God gave you. Michael, fortunately or unfortunately, had enough money to be able to do what he did, and he was able to act out, you know, his self-hatred in public for all to see. But our parents have to realize that at the end of the day, do we really want to make our living and singing and dancing and entertaining, you know, the world in order to be accepted? Nobody else has to do that. Chris Rock made a statement. He says, the community I live in, Jay-Z lives there, and Mary J. Blige. We are all entertainers, we're all famous, and we make money. He says, my next-door neighbor is a dentist.
Right.
You know, he lives in a gated community in northern Jersey. What kind of job does a dentist do in order to afford to live in his neighborhood? He's got to be more than teeth. You know what I mean? It's got to be more than teeth. So my thing is that at the end of the day, it's about ownership. And again, this is where the sovereignty thing comes in. We have to own and control land as a people. That is a source of all wealth. Yes, you can make money singing and dancing and all that kind of stuff, but at the end of the day, you have to control land. The sovereignty is directly tied into control of land, and land is directly related to and leads to the ability to be sovereign as a people. So entertainment might get you some money, it might got you a nice house, nice place, and relative social acceptance up to a point. when they get tired of you or when you do something they don't like. And another person, I want to make a prediction real quick, and I'll let you get on with your next question. It's Oprah Winfrey. Okay. I'm already seeing the winds of change are going on Oprah. And I think because people got pissed off at her because of her early support of Barack Obama. A lot of people believe that she should have stayed out of that because of her influence and this, that, and the third. But I'm already seeing articles and think there was an article I think on the cover of Time or Newsweek a couple weeks ago talking about Oprah and how weird she's getting and all this. I'm like, wait a minute, Oprah doing the same stuff she's been doing for the last 25 years.
Right.
When did she get weird? You know, but it turned on her, you know, beginning to turn. So your favor with non-African people, in this case European people in America, is only as good as your ability to constantly please them. And who wants to go around living like that? That's not really being free. No matter how much money you got, or no matter how much money you make.
You know, I was reading an article the other day, and they were saying how Michael Jackson actually, he planned a lot of the media attention that he got. That he, first of all, they were talking about the Neverland, man, and how he actually had his own fire department. He had his own police department, you know. He had
absolutely
his own water filtration, you know, system.
Yep.
His own disposal, you know, everything. I mean, he had an entire city in Neverland, you know. And how he would drum up a lot of this, you know, media publicity that he would get and then cry foul when he was getting it, you know. So he would do things like, you know, call the paper about him sleeping in a, you know, sleeping in a, what was it, in a bubble or some kind of thing he was sleeping in. And then, you know, he would leak that to the media. Then they, you know, when they put the information out, then he would cry foul, people picking on him, what have you. But I think you made a very clear point that if there were more black people that had money like Michael Jackson, that there would be more black people repeating some of the things that he is doing. You know, which
absolutely
is very interesting. It's very interesting, you know. So, changing gears again, I just wanted to throw a little bit in there about Michael Jackson, if we could. But changing gears back to this whole sense of black people having our own, you know, nation and what have you. You know, I want to talk a little bit about the men that are in this movement. You know, I talk quite frequently with a few sister friends and some brothers, what have you. And, you know, we always talk about the men that are in the movement, and a lot of them, you know, having knowledge of self, having some sense of consciousness, having some sense of political awareness about themselves. But those brothers are not ones to, if I may use another, I guess, broad, you know, entertainer, you know, Steve Harvey, you know, we talked about this book and many of his, you know, ideology, what have you, is not really representing the African paradigm, but he talked about the three P's in his book. He said that men profess, you know, for women, they profess, they protect, and they provide. But we're not finding even brothers that are willing to profess, you know, for the black women, let alone provide and protect. So, you know, can we talk a little bit about the state of where the black man is, you know, in America today or throughout the world, and his ability and or inability to, you know, reclaim his you know, his rightful place in, as you know, in the household. No, I didn't say the head of the household. I just said household because I don't want no flat from any women, brother. But go ahead.
Yeah, no, African men. Again, it goes back to slavery. We've been denatured. So a lot of brothers don't even know what it means to be a man. You know, we have a lot of what I call overgrown adolescents walking around. You know, overgrown adolescent males. But you know, to be a man, you know, in the African sense of the word, when I went through my, you know, I won't call it rites of passage, but when I was being, you know, introduced to manhood, one of my mentors said that, you know, the first coat that a man puts on in order to be a man is the coat of responsibility. You have to be responsible. You have to be responsible. And, you know, that comes before, you know, bravery and putting money on the table and all that. You have to be responsible, you know, and in fact, he said, you know, and I later learned, you know, when you go home to Africa, he says, if you don't have a wife and children, you're not considered a man.
Right.
In traditional African society. Because basically, you're not responsible for anything or anybody other than yourself. And that's the equivalent of being a child. So again, in America, it's just supposed to that mentality with what we have over here in America, where you have a bunch of people that have been basically, not even celebrated, but the people have been raised to believe that it's their right to make choices and be free and do what they want to do. And no. Manhood and womanhood are social functions that are defined by the people. They're not defined by you. So But when you got a society that worships the individual to the point of you know, of ridiculousness, then you got a bunch of people out there running around saying, I'm the man, I'm this, I'm that, I can be... No, you can't. If you're not, and this is, again, traditional, this is what our ancestors said. This is not what Baba Sekou said. So whoever's listening out there, don't get mad at me. But a man must be married to a woman, not to another man, not to a dog or a cat or a cow, but to a woman. And if he's an African man, he should be married to an African woman. I'm going to go a step further. And he should have children, his own, hers, or theirs together. It doesn't matter. We're not going to get into, you know, that. If he has children he's responsible for, and he accepts them as his children, he is a man. Okay?
Right.
And that's the basic foundation for man. Then we go on from there. But the fundamental thing for man, and I'm going to say it again, is marriage and fatherhood. Short of those two things, you cannot be, and the African says now, you cannot be considered a man. And that's what the ancestors say.
I share.
All due respect to Steve Harvey.
I say. I'm pretty sure Steve Harvey's not listening, brother, but you know, it's all good. But so, all right, so moving forward, we have about, we got good time. I guess we got another 20 minutes or so. You know, can you please tell the people that's listening, you know, a little bit about Ijoba Shule? You know, I know you did in the beginning, but just how they can get in contact with you, you know, your website, you know, your phone number, where you are located, and any of the, you know, pertinent information, any activities y'all have coming up, events, those kind of things, so we can get that out.
Well, Ijoba Shule, we just concluded our fourth year of operation, we're proud to say. We're on summer break right now, so there are no events coming up. But if you want to find out more about our Shule and get in contact with us, please visit www.ijobashule.org, and I'll spell that. Ijoba Shule, I-J, as in John, O-B-A, S-H-U-L-E, .org. And our number... we can be reached at 215, area code 215-747-5737. We're located in West Philadelphia, right on 51st and 52nd on Walnut Street on the third floor in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
You know, I recall coming into the Egg Bay, you know, years ago, coming into, you know, into your space in Philadelphia. And I recall when I, you know, when I first joined the Egg Bay, I'm talking in 2002, 2003, you know, there was a large group of, you know, folk that would come in, or those that were part of the Egg Bay and those that, you know, come in on weekends or, you know, come and visit every now and then and what have you. And I can recall remembering how vibrant of energy that, you know, you, I hate to, like, you know, you know, make you an idol or anything, but, you know, that you basically, you know, brought to the Egg Bay. I mean, of course, you and your family and all the members, what have you, but, and so, you know, and I look around to other cities and so, and I'm seeing that the communities, you know, our African communities are getting smaller and smaller and smaller, you know, and in most of those communities, they're largely women than they are men, you know what I mean, and this is an issue. And so, you know, I've been in discussion with a lot of sister friends and stuff. Well, again, I'm on this topic of men. You know, one of the larger issues is, you know, where are the men? You know, where are the, you know, where are the you know, the conscious men, the brothers, you know, and those that are in the movement? Again, they're somehow not, either they're not trying to get married or they're playing games or they're not trying to, you know, be serious or what have you. And so this becomes a critical issue, not necessarily just for the men, but then for the boys. You know, because we're having boys who are being raised. Many times they're coming to our activities, they're coming to our shoelaces, they're coming to our events, and it's the mamas who are bringing them into the institutions. You know, so what charge do we have to help raise up those brothers? Or is that our charge, number two, to help raise up those brothers? But, you know, to help women understand that we are, you know, one of our roles as men is to mark our territory. You know what I'm saying? And to make sure that women are, you know, they feel a sense of protection and, you know, and those kind of things. So I'm just trying to understand, what is our role as those that have 2 feet in the movement, you know, to kind of, I guess, help other brothers, you know, to come along or do what we're supposed to do or what have you?
Well, the first thing we're supposed to do is, like you said, man, you said, you got to have 2 feet in the movement. That means that you can't betray this thing. We gotta be in it to win it, no matter what happens, no matter who comes and who goes, we have to represent. Second thing we have to do, again, we have to be husbands and fathers to our children. we can't even talk about saving or helping or aiding other young brothers out there or even our peers if we're losing our own sons. And, you know, and they're not developing into men. My first responsibility is to raise my boy to be a man, to be my replacement. As a matter of fact, in the manhood society in which I belong, that is the number one charge of all the men in our brotherhood, which is we cannot die until we have prepared our replacement. You know what I'm saying? That literally, that's kind of what kind of pressure we put ourselves under. That we have to prepare people that are young men who are capable of inheriting what it is we have created, what it is we're building, and then moving that thing forward and being able to recreate themselves. That is the key. So that's our first responsibility. Now, after that, if there's any other young men out there that I can or peers that I can reach or help or work with, then I'm obligated to try to do that. But my first responsibility is to my own and to those young men in my purview. And by that, I would mean make nephews and you know, young men like that. Little brothers, if you have, like I have a little brother who's just 10. So he's technically young enough to be my son. So all those brothers. But he's, you know, I'm going to try to do everything I can to help him to become a man. You know what I'm saying? I'm obligated to do that. And that's all we can do. The sisters out there, I would say to them, you know, that you're not enough men standing up, and you know the men are sleeping on the job. Well, that's true to some degree. That at the end of the day, only black men can make, only African men can make men. Sisters can help, and they can do their part. But ultimately, we have to create the men, create the standard, and then hold other brothers to that standard. And we're not at that stage yet. Right now, we are in a stage where we have to keep ourselves together. We have to keep ourselves healthy and strong. And we have to prepare our replacements and prepare as many boys as we possibly can until we get this momentum going in the other direction where African manhood is the norm, African manhood is what's expected, and it's what's seen and exampled every day. So we have a lot of work in front of us and everything and all. And you know, the last thing I'll say to you, Baba, and I tell this to a lot of young brothers, is don't go out there and try to be a savior, you know, or prove to black women or African women out there that, you know, all brothers ain't bad. You don't have to do that, you know. I know it's noble and all, but it's not, you can't win that battle. You know, you can't make up for all the hurt and the pain and the neglect and all the things that have happened, you know, in other sisters' lives at the hands of brothers. You know, and it's not your job, it's not your duty. All you can do is be a good example, take care of your family, and let that be your signature. Let that be your, you know, your credential.
Right, Ashe. So, you know, I appreciate that. I appreciate your, response on that question. You know, I mean, I hate to put it to you like that. What's your philosophy on where our men are? Because, you know, I mean, you know, you're not responsible, I guess, to some degree, you know, largely for a lot of the brothers and what have you. But again, you know, there are men that are within our purview, our friends. You know, we have friends and associates and stuff like that that, you know, a lot of times we look at them and look at the way that they're doing certain things. Of course, you and I have had discussions offline, of course, about men that we know who father children, and they just bounce, you know, and they step. And so the woman,
right,
you know, is stuck with a child, no father around, and what have you. And I'm teetering on a discussion that I don't think I should have right now, but I will put it to you like this. You know, as a community, what do we do with all of these single mothers? You know what I'm saying? And how do we begin to help a lot of these single mothers with children? You know, a lot of these young men, like, what's on my mind is this manhood training that I'm having
right,
in Trenton, or that we're having here in Trenton for boys 7 to 13 years old. And, you know, all of the women who have approached, all of the parents who have approached us have been single mothers.
Right.
You know, which is no surprise. But, like, you know, it's just interesting because they know that they need their boys around men. The men are just, they're not around, man. And a lot of these dudes are boys, you know, they talk about what they doing and how they had a son, but they had their son like once a month, you know,
right,
or twice a month,
right,
or what have you. So this is an issue that's plaguing our community. And I'm just, you know, I don't know, this is on my chest, and I'm trying to, like, have a discussion about it, that we have brothers, and then we have brothers in the movement that have a little political consciousness or have a little social consciousness or what have you, but then they're not ready to get married, they're not ready to have no children, they're just trying to make money. You know what I'm saying? Or you know, or do something that is more capitalistic minded, or, you know what I'm saying? Like, they're not really trying to be, you know, 2 feet deep in the movement or what have you. So it's just like
right,
a cycle. So the question I'm asking you, Bob, I guess I'm babbling, but the question I'm asking to you is, you know, how do we begin to connect the dots with the fragmented community that we have, and, you know, trying to bring it all together as a sovereign nation?
Well, Bob,
as an effective sovereign nation, but go ahead.
No problem. I don't want to sound pessimistic, but you really can't. We really can't. All we can do is try to help and to, you know, and to reach out and touch as many lives as we can and hope for the best, but that's not really doing it. You know, even if, we're trying to go, you and I, we both have fight for justice programs, and then we work with the boys and the girls. We've had ours for several years in our ENA. And, it helps. And I'm not saying it's not worth it. But at the end of the day, Baba, the only thing we can do, we have to create families. And right. There's no substitute for family. There's no substitute for a man being in the home with his wife and with his children and being a man, being an example of a man, being an example of a father, being an example of a husband, being an example of a worker, being an example of a revolutionary, being an example of a person in pursuit of sovereignty. There's no substitute for that. Yeah, and then, exactly. So, exactly. And when that boy and that little girl looks up and sees mom and dad doing those things, how do you substitute for that? How do you make up for that? The other thing I'll say is this. Is that in our movement, and by our movement, I'm talking about, the people that you and I associate with at the various things that we go to around the country.
Right.
You see men like that. We have men in our community that are elders in their 70s, 60s, 50s. I'm in my 40s. You're in your 30s. There's consistency there. There's continuity. And there's not a lot of us, but it's there. The other thing we see is that in that movement, we're held to a standard. In our world, you can't even get up on a dais. You can't even make a speech. You can't even give a lesson. You can't even, unless you're a man, unless you have a wife, unless you have children, unless you're putting in some work, you have some institution. Think about it. And what we need to do, you and myself and brothers like us, when we go into our communities, we need to be the same way.
Right.
We can't sit there and think because a brother read a couple books or because he got a couple of initiations or some beads around his neck that all of a sudden he's down, but his family is nowhere to be seen. Or his wife, or his children. No. And people say, "Well, y'all being self-righteous." Well, God damn it, no. Excuse my language, but no, we're not being self-righteous. We're holding men to a standard.
Right.
We're holding them to a standard. We're holding ourselves to that standard. We're being held to that standard. And if we should slip, then people should step to us like that as well. And that's what I'm saying. Is that this is, we have to start drawing a line and enforcing the rule of law. And this is what the rule of law is all about.
You're right. And I guess I was begging that, question, because that's essentially what I was trying to get out there. We cannot judge another brother, because ain't none of us, none of us perfect, All of us have to, to improve on our character. We all have to improve on, who we are as men and what have you. But at the same time, there are many of our brothers who don't even have the whole notion of family in their mindset in terms of what they're, trying to do. And so we definitely have to do that. And I think the point that you just made, I want to highlight again, is that when we create institutions, with brothers and what have you, that, one of the major tenets have to be in terms of, seniority or status or what have you, is whether or not you're married and how well you maintain your family. Your business, not how many cars you have, not how many whips you got, how many girls, none of that. None of that really matters. It's how well you maintain your family. And the meeting that we had last week, it was very interesting. The man who training meeting that we had, all the Babas that were there were married.
Good.
It was very interesting. Brother Mancho, Brother Cafele, myself, all the brothers that were there, they all were married. Now, we stopped for a second and thought about it. Brother Rashid, I don't want to forget him, Adade King, we looked around, we said, we're all married, And that was a good thing because, we all have a certain shared understanding about certain things that single men just do not have,
Right.
And so that's a real interesting piece. So, please.
And that's the thing y'all have is the responsibility of manhood.
Right.
That's the thing y'all share. Y'all responsible for other people.
Right. Right. In closing, we have another, 10 minutes or so. I just want to, connect all of this to the larger picture of the Council of Independent Black Institutions, CB. We are both CB organizations, the Garvey School, Egon Omode Shule, and of course, Ijoba Shule are members of CB. And our institution, of course, we are always in and around other babas and mamas who reflect the concept of African complementarity.
Right.
We can see institutions like Nation House, we can see institutions like Hofi Nkwenu Academy in St. Louis, where there's a Baba and there's an Iya, there's a mother and a father who are running the institutions. And so I want to talk a little bit about the importance of African complementarity in terms of leadership on, you know, as a means to us having a sovereign, you know, either nation or sovereign institutions. But, you know, this concept of African complementarity being very important to that, you know, to that, for that, you know, for that function.
Well, Bobby, you just mentioned a fourth tenet of what it is to be an African. We talked about Maat earlier, and we talked about all of the belief of, you know, knowing that we all come from, you know, the ancient Hopi Valley. But another one is complementarity. And again, that's another aspect, ironically, of Maat, which is male-female balance. You know, and not symbolic. I'm not talking about symbolic. I'm talking about male-female balance in leadership, male-female balance in, as far as, you know, politics is concerned, and in education and spirituality and all of that. You know, when I, for example, and this is just, a, you know, something I want to share with the audience. When I look at you, when I first met you, again, you were single, you know, you were on the path to being married, and, you know, it didn't work out with that sister. But the point is that I look at you now, and, you know, I see how much more enhanced you are as a man, how much more stature you have, you know, just, you know, to me, you know, much less the rest of the community, because of your wife, who she is. You know, Mama Makita carries a lot of you know, weight, man, I mean, as far as just the level of respect that I have for her and that most people in our community have for her, and the fact that that's your wife, you know what I mean, and
right.
That you were the kind of man that could, you know, not attract a woman like that, but then, you know, marry her and you know, do all the things that a man is supposed to, and vice versa, that y'all both enhance each other, and that's the beautiful thing. That's what complementarity is really all about, is that, you know, and I look at my wife, and I'm like, you know, I'm the man that I am. You know, yes, my parents raised me to become this kind of man and all that, but I really didn't really start actualizing it until I was able to attract and marry and to, you know, make family with a woman of the caliber of my wife. And
right.
That is what complementarity is. You grow and go together and make
right.
both parties that much better. And then you're able to give full perspective a lot of times. A lot of times when I sit down with some people and I'm doing either divination or I might just be counseling somebody. The house, we're just talking, you know, like you said, chopping it up. And sometimes they'll say something and I'm like, you know, my wife might not be in the room. I say, you know, come here, I want you to, you know, hear this. What do you think about that? And she'll give it, you know, and it's like it came from me, even though it came from her, because we're together. You know what I'm saying? We're one.
Right.
I know, for example, that this person might not need to hear what I have to say, but Ola Day is going to bring that perspective, because she is, you know, a woman. Not only is she a woman, but she's of a certain kind of caliber where when she speaks, you know, this is, you know, what it is and all. But if she wasn't there, all I could give was what I have. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But because she is there, and because we work together and we're a team, and I respect her, her mind and her ideas and the way she thinks, even though we don't always agree, that's irrelevant. Listen to her, because she's going to tell you something that you need to hear, or something that may give you a different perspective and make you think about this thing a different way. So complementarity is absolutely essential, because it balances us out. It keeps that testosterone, you know, balanced and get going too far. Bob Ozzie always says that men are the fire. We are the, you know, we start things and all, but it's the women that bring this up to completion a lot of times. So
right.
We need that balance.
Yeah, I remember talking to my man Moncho about how, you know, when he was getting married, you know, or before he got married, you know, I was telling him, you know, I said, man, when you get married, you know, this is going to really enhance your life. You're going to be this, that, and other, boom, bah, boom. And then when
yep.
he got married, you know what I'm saying? I mean, he came back to me and said to me, yo, brother, now I understand what you're saying. You know, because
right.
his life had just become, it just became encapsulated. Like, he was this, you know, individual brother, you know, loose, well, not even saying loose in terms of women, but just, you know, running from here, going there, and things wasn't being, you know, brought together for him. When he got married, man, he slowed down. You know what I'm saying? The business came together. Now they have a Coma House initiative. They're doing
right.
lectures together. They're doing all
right.
these things together. And it was his wife that helped bond that for him. You know?
Right.
And so that's a very important point, man. And I give you, you know, most I say to that, because it definitely makes sense, you know. So again, you know, in closing, you know, we had a healthy discussion today. We talked about the European tradition. We talked about sovereignty. We talked about African education. And, you know, I want for you to give your information to the listeners again before we get off the show, so people can know how to contact you, Ijoba Shule, and also Ijoba, Egbe Ijoba.
Okay, well, again, thank you for inviting me and having me on. It was an honor. Again, I can be reached at Eric 5747-5737. If I don't answer, you know, leave a message in my mailbox, and I will get back to you. Anybody who wants to email me, my email address is oscar, S is in Sam, O is in Oscar, L is in Larry, A is in Anthony, Y is in the yes, I is in Isaac, N is in Nancy, K as in kangaroo and A as in Anthony, at comcast.net. That's Comcast, comcast.net. That's my email. Again, we are always open to visitors and welcome guests on Sundays, 10 o'clock a.m. in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, at our temple, which is at 5150 Walnut Street, 5150 Walnut Street, third floor. And every Sunday, we get together, either usually at our temple, but some Sundays we do go out of town and we fellowship with others. On the third floor there at 5151 Street, 10 o'clock a.m., all we ask people to do is to just, you know, be clean, physically, mentally, and spiritually, come clean, and, you know, be open-minded and, you know, be ready to, you know, participate. You can wear traditional clothes if you want, but you don't have to. You can wear white if you want, but you don't have to. Just be clean and be, you know, ready to participate, and we'd love to have you.
I'm glad to have you on the show tonight, Baba. You know, I got to get you on again. You know, at some point next time, we have to probably approach the economic aspect of this movement. You know, we should talk about how, you know, we're going to fund this movement and some of, you know, some put some solution-based things on paper, you know, next time we talk. So, again,
okay.
I want to thank you for coming on the show tonight, Baba.
Thank
my
you.
My guest was Obaseku Olayinka. And you are listening to The Liberated Zone with your host, Baye Kemet. And stay tuned. We will be back next Monday at 9 p.m. Ashe o.